On this show, we're going to listen to Chris Hedges, first in an interview that he did with George Galloway, who is a British politician. And then we're going to follow that with a speech that Chris Hedges gave at the Kairos Club in London on September 11th, 2024. So here is George Galloway interviewing Chris Hedges.
Chris Hedges, a wise owl if ever I saw one, political commentator, journalist, writer, and host of the inimitable Chris Hedges Report, joins me now from the United States. Chris, this is, it feels to me, a momentous evening. The scale and nature of the Israeli terrorist attack on Lebanon is likely to be a spark that brings the much-discussed wider war in the Middle East, at least according to me. What about you?
Yes, and it follows a pattern. So if you know the history of Gaza as well as I do, but there would be an uneasy ceasefire, and Israel would break the ceasefire and carry out provocations that they knew would elicit a response by Hamas and other resistance groups. And we're seeing the same pattern here. Remember that these explosions came a day after the Israeli cabinet released a decision that a priority now was to return Israelis to the north. About 80,000 have been displaced. There have been reports in the Israeli press that there are disputes between the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, over a war in Lebanon. And then there have been rumors that Netanyahu will even dismiss Gallant and replace him with the far right politician Gideon Sarar. On Monday, commander of the Israeli Northern Front recommended that the government conduct an offensive to create a buffer zone within the Lebanese southern Lebanon. And this takes place, of course, a month after Hezbollah launched a drone or rocket attack that targeted Israel's military intelligence headquarters near Tel Aviv. That attack was in retaliation for Israel's assassination of the top Hezbollah commander, Fahud Shakar, and this was in late July in Beirut. Assassination took place the next day. There was an assassination of Hamas's Politburo chief, Ismail Haniyeh. So we've now watched for several weeks these provocations by Israel. Israel knows very well that those provocations demand a response, but I think you're right. What we're seeing now is at a whole other level, talking about thousands of people. And remember, many of these people are not Hezbollah fighters. They may work for Hezbollah, but they work often in civilian infrastructure. These things were going off, exploding in supermarkets while people were driving cars. It killed children. Then, of course, today now we've had apparently walkie-talkies. So, yes, Israel provokes on purpose. This is a massive provocation. All signs are that there will be an incursion by Israeli forces into southern Lebanon, perhaps even once again a bombing of Beirut. You know, this fits the pattern, both in terms of Israel's long animosity towards Hezbollah and Lebanon, but also its animosity towards the Palestinians in Gaza. But the consequences of this could be catastrophic. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm terrified for what comes next.
An Israeli incursion, as you put it, invasion, I said, will be, of course, hotly contested. The Lebanese resistance is very strong and numerous and with a quite awesome firepower, according to Israeli sources themselves, quite apart from the fact they have powerful friends around the region. It is possible that an Israeli invasion of Lebanon could be their bloodiest ever, costliest ever incursion, invasion into an Arab country.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, both Iran and Hezbollah have actually acted up until now with amazing restraint. But yes, and it's interesting that the Israeli press reports are saying that Israeli Ministry of Transportation officials are preparing for a potential attack on the port of Haifa and Ben Gurion Airport. That, of course, is something that we have not seen, something that that would really begin to shut down the ability of Israel to operate. But I think the fact that Israeli officials are expecting something of that magnitude buttresses your point that this will be conducted at a level that we haven't yet seen. No, I don't think that Israel's success with an incursion is in any way assured. Hezbollah is not Hamas. Hamas's rockets, I mean, to be fair, are largely ineffectual, very small compared to the missile systems provided by Iran, of course, that Hezbollah possesses. So yes, if Hezbollah decides to go all out, then I think that the possibility of this ending very badly for Israel is likely.
Now, my government has been active on social media today. Ironically, on one of them I just saw, the Foreign Office said that they stood four square with the United States against cybercrime and the hacking of electronic equipment. But they've been busy on other things, large and small. But none of the British government ministers have found a single word of condemnation of what, by any measure, is a terrorist attack, pregnant with the possibility that others will now copy it. Others with whom they're less chummy will now copy it. Is it the same in the US?
Yes. The irony is that you have that US mediator, Hochstein, who's in Israel right now, I think, attempting, well, according to the State Department, to diffuse tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Well, you're not going to diffuse tensions between Israel and Hezbollah when over the last 2 days you've had thousands of people wounded, many quite seriously, many civilians. This is also fits this kind of pattern of Israel essentially running rogue, doing anything it wants, and the U.S., because of the Zionist lobby, which owns Congress, essentially being unable to curb the most rapacious and aggressive behavior by Israel, which, and of course, Israel expects that should it get into trouble with Iran, the United States will militarily intervene on its side. And they may not be wrong. I mean, Netanyahu has long tried to drag the United States into a conflict with Iran, just like the Israeli government dragged the United States into the Iraq war. That was a Zionist neoliberal or neoconservative project, which didn't end well for the United States, but managed to essentially break the one regional power that posed a serious threat to Israel, and that was the Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein. So it served Israel's interests. It did not serve the interests of the United States, certainly not the interests within the region. There's the consequences of this regionally for the United States, and maybe ultimately for Israel, are deeply distressing.
Now, it turns out to have been quite a simple affair. The only barrier, really, is whether you would do such a thing, not whether you could do such a thing. Motorola say they are completely innocent. They sold a license to what turned out to be a shell company in Hungary using a Middle East bank, intriguingly. And that company then produced Motorola goods, except they were filled with explosive. Anybody could do that, Chris, couldn't they? And now, almost certainly, they will.
Yeah, of course. It becomes another template. I think, you know, there's no question this is an act of terrorism, state terrorism on the part of Israel. But yes, of course, once you begin to employ these acts of terror, you get copycat terror. I mean, remember, this is a few years ago, but the I think it was ISIS captured a Jordanian pilot. And what did they do? They put the pilot in a cage and burned him alive, because that's what, of course, Jordanian and American and NATO planes were doing to them. So, yes, I mean, go all the way back to 9/11. The hijackers of 9/11 speak the language that we taught them. Which was massive explosions and death above a city skyline. We've been doing it since Vietnam, when Robert McNamara called the massive bombing campaign, the Christmas bombing campaign of North Vietnam, a way to, quote-unquote, send a message to Hanoi. So I think you make an extremely important point that the atrocities we carry out are then often visited upon us. And yeah, I think that you're right. This is down the road. This will be something that will be visited on Israel and perhaps its allies.
They may have done it before, of course. I've been deeply skeptical about the helicopter crash that murdered the president of Iran and the foreign minister of Iran. I'm wondering if they had a pager or a Motorola radio in the helicopter?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Remember that, you know, going back to the so-called bomb maker in Gaza, they were doing this with cell phones, which is why resistance groups switched away from the cell phones, not only because they were tracking devices and you could be monitored, but because we had already seen Israel use mobile devices or turn mobile devices into explosives.
What do you think the implications are for the electronics industry of all this? I posited in my introductory remarks that if you lived in the global south, if you lived in a country that the United States and the United Kingdom had bad relations with or even designated as an enemy, you'd have to be a fool to be carrying around Western technology in your pocket or in your car. Am I right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And especially because there will be no accountability. You can be sure of that. So, yeah, I think it's just one more step, which we have seen in this kind of multipolar universe. And we can begin with all of the sanctions against Russia. You have seen a stepping away from that Western hegemony, not only within the banking system, but within the technology sector. So, yeah, I think this is one more step in the fragmentation of the world. I mean, why? That's a, you raise a completely legitimate point. Why could you ever trust these companies again? Especially as I cannot stress enough, the fact that nobody will be held, Israel, which probably clearly did it, is not going to be held accountable. Nobody's going to be held accountable.
Turning, if I may, finally, Chris, to the Ukraine. We're asking the question in our poll tonight, is Zelensky finished? Do you think he is?
I don't know. It's, you know, the Ukrainian oligarchic system is pretty corrupt, and it's greased by money, of which apparently Zelensky has quite a bit. So I don't know. Well, I'm going to have to be an agnostic on that question.
Thank you very much, as always, Chris Hedges, political commentator supreme, the man who in a sane world would be occupying Foggy Bottom as Secretary of State.
And next we have Chris Hedges again speaking at the Kairos Club in London, September 11th, 2024.
Friedrich Nietzsche, in Beyond Good and Evil, holds that only a few people have the fortitude to look in times of distress into what he calls the molten pit of human reality, most studiously ignore the pit. Artists and philosophers for Nietzsche are consumed, however, by an insatiable curiosity, a quest for truth, and a desire for meaning. They venture down into the bowels of the molten pit. They get as close as they can before the flames and heat drive them back. This intellectual and moral honesty, Nietzsche wrote, comes with a cost. Those singed by the fire of reality become burnt children, he wrote, eternal orphans in empires of illusion. Dying civilizations make war on independent intellectual inquiry, art, and culture for this reason. They do not want the masses to look into the pit. They condemn and vilify the burnt people, including my friend Roger Hallam. They feed the human addiction for illusion, happiness, and the mania for hope. They peddle the fantasy of eternal material progress and the cult of the self. They insist, and this is the argument of neoliberalism, that the ruling ideology, one posited on ceaseless exploitation and ever-expanding accumulation, that funnels money upwards into the hands of a global billionaire class, is decreed by natural law. We did not use the word optimist and pessimist in war. Those in war who could not coldly assess the world around them, who could not grasp the bleakness and mortal danger they faced, who had a childish belief in their own immortality or a mania for hope, did not live long. There is, as Clive Hamilton in Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change notes, a dark relief that comes from accepting that catastrophic climate change is virtually certain. This obliteration of false hopes, he says, requires an intellectual knowledge and an emotional knowledge. This intellectual knowledge is attainable. Emotional knowledge, because it means that those we love, including our children, are almost certainly doomed to insecurity, misery, and suffering within a few decades, if not a few years, is much harder to acquire. To emotionally accept impending disaster, to attain the gut-level understanding that the global power elite will not respond rationally to the devastation of the ecosystem is as difficult to accept as our own mortality. The most daunting existential struggle of our time is to ingest this awful truth intellectually and emotionally, and yet rise up to resist the forces that are destroying us. I covered uprisings and revolutions around the globe for 2 decades. The insurgencies in Central America, Algeria, Yemen, the Sudan, and the Punjab. The 2 Palestinian uprisings, the revolutions in 1989 in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. And the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. Revolutions and uprisings are spontaneous combustions. No one, including the revolutionaries, the burnt children, are able to predict them. The February 1917 revolution was like the French storming of the Bastille, an unexpected and unplanned popular eruption. As the hapless Alexander Kerensky pointed out, the Russian Revolution came of its own accord, unengineered by anyone, born in the chaos of the collapse of Tsardom. The tinder is recognizable. What sets it alight is a mystery. A population rises up against a decayed system not because of revolutionary consciousness, but because, as Rosa Luxemburg pointed out, it has no other choice. It is the obtuseness of the old regime, not the work of revolutionaries, that triggers revolt. And as she pointed out, all revolutions are in some sense failures, events that begin rather than culminate a process of social transformation. There was no predetermined plan, no organized action, because the appeals of the parties could scarcely keep pace with the spontaneous rising of the masses, she wrote, of the 1905 uprising in Russia. The leaders had scarcely time to formulate the watchwords of the onrushing crowd. Revolutions, she continued, cannot be at command, nor is this at all the task of the party. Our duty is only at all times to speak out plainly, without fear or trembling. That is, to hold clearly before the masses their tasks in the given historical moment and to proclaim the political program of action and the slogans which result from the situation. The concern with whether and when the revolutionary mass movement takes up with them must be left confidently to history itself. Even though socialism may at first appear as a voice crying in the wilderness, it yet provides for itself a moral and political position, the fruits of which it later, when the hour of historical fulfillment strikes, garners with compound interest. No one could have predicted that the First Intifada in 1987 would erupt in the Jabalia refugee camp after an Israeli truck driver collided with a car, killing four Palestinian workers. No one could have foreseen that the decision by a Tunisian fruit vendor whose scales had been confiscated by police because he was working without a license to set himself on fire in protest in December 2010 would spark the Arab Spring. While the moment of eruption is mysterious, it are the visionaries and utopian reformers, such as the abolitionists, who make possible real social change, never the practical politicians. The abolitionists destroyed what the historian Eric Foner calls the conspiracy of silence, by which political parties, churches, and other institutions sought to exclude slavery from public debate. He writes, "For much of the 1850s and the first part of the Civil War, Lincoln, widely considered the model of a pragmatic politician, advocated a plan to end slavery that involved gradual emancipation, monetary compensation for slave owners, and setting up colonies of freed blacks outside the United States. The harebrained scheme had no possibility of enactment. It was the abolitionists, still viewed by some historians as irresponsible fanatics, who put forward the program, an immediate and uncompensated end to slavery, with black people becoming U.S. citizens. That came to pass with Lincoln's eventual help, of course. As Foner points out, it is the fanatics who make history. Vladimir Lenin argued that the most effective way to weaken the resolve of the ruling elite was to tell it exactly what to expect. This brazenness attracts the notice of state security, but it gives the movement an honesty and cachet. The revolutionary, he wrote, must make unequivocal demands that, if met, would mean the obliteration of the current power structure. The revolutions in Eastern Europe were led by a handful of dissidents who, until the fall of 1989, were marginal and dismissed by the state as inconsequential until it was too late. The state periodically sent state security to harass them. It often ignored them. And I'm not even sure you could call these dissidents an opposition. They were profoundly isolated within their own societies. The state media denied them a voice. They had no legal status and were locked out of the political system. They were blacklisted. They struggled to make a living. But when the breaking point in Eastern Europe came, when the ruling communist ideology lost all credibility, there was no question in the minds of the public about whom they could trust. The demonstrators that poured into the streets of East Berlin and Prague were aware of who would sell them out and who would not. They trusted those such as Václav Havel, who I and other reporters met each night at the Magic Lantern Theater in Prague during the revolution, who had dedicated their lives to fighting for an open society. Those who had been willing to be condemned as non-persons and to go to jail for their defiance. Our only chance to overthrow corporate power and halt the looming ecocide comes from those who will not surrender to it, who will hold fast no matter the price, who are willing to be dismissed and reviled by a bankrupt liberalism. They exposed the hollowness of the ruling class. They forced the state to respond, evidenced when Parliament declared a climate emergency following mass protests organized by Extinction Rebellion, and the decision by Dutch lawmakers to reduce fuel subsidies after the blockage of roadways. Those who accept risks, including long prison terms, penetrate the consciousness of the wider society, including the security organs that protect it. That penetration from the outside is impossible to measure, but it steadily erodes the foundations of power until what appears as a solid edifice, as I witnessed with the Stasi state in East Germany and Ceausescu's Romania, seemingly crumbles overnight. The ossified systems of governance, evidenced in the United States by our corporate-managed elections, our system of legalized bribery, our commercialized press, and our captive judiciary, which has legalized gerrymandering, an updated version of Britain's 19th-century rotten borough, exposes the political class as puppets of the ruling corporate cabal. Reform through these structures is impossible. As the system calcifies, it carries out ever more draconian repression. Abuses of power, unlawful government policies, whether the war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan exposed by WikiLeaks, the Grenfell fire, or the refusal to address the climate crisis that will lead to mass death and societal collapse, are ignored, and those who decry them persecuted. Roger's 5-year prison sentence and the 4-year prison terms of the other Just Stop Oil activists are justified by laws formulated by the fossil fuel industry, such as conspiracy to interfere with national infrastructure or the new lock-on law that can see a protester who attaches his or herself to an object, land, or other person with some form of adhesive or handcuffs go to prison for 4.5 years. The hearings and trials for the Just Stop Oil activists, like those held for Julian, deny the accused the right to submit objective evidence. The show trials are a Dickensian farce. They mock the ideals of British jurisprudence and replicate the worst days of the Lubyanka. These activists were not convicted for taking part in protests, but for its planning. The evidence used in court to convict them came from an online Zoom meeting that was captured by Scarlett Howes, a reporter posing as a supporter from The Sun. And no doubt, some fossil fuel think tank is dreaming up a journalism prize for her now. And as Linda Lochdear, the legal director of Climate Rights International, points out, sentences for those engaging in climate protest have steadily become harsher and harsher, longer than many of the sentences imposed on those who engaged in acts of violence during the racist riots in Southport. It is not accidental that the imprisonment of these climate activists coincides with the arrests of journalists and activists who seek to halt the genocide in Gaza, including Sarah Wilkinson, Richard Barnard, the co-founder of Palestine Action, which has disrupted the work of weapons factories linked to Israel's genocide, including Elbit Systems, along with the arrest of the British Syrian journalist Richard Medhurst, whose plane was intercepted on the tarmac by police vehicles so he could be apprehended before he reached the gate, as well as the former British ambassador and journalist Craig Murray, who was detained under Section 7 of the UK Terrorism Act. Section 7 is the kind of Orwellian tool that defines the corporate state. It permits police, along with customs officials, to stop any person at any sea, land, or airport of entry and interrogate them for up to 6 hours. There is no right to refuse to answer questions. There is no right to have a lawyer present. Any documents, PINs, or passwords must be provided upon demand. Fingerprints and DNA samples can be taken. Anyone convicted of frustrating a Schedule 7 request can receive a fine of up to £2,500 and imprisonment for up to the next 3 months. The UK government has used Schedule 7 powers to interrogate and obtain information from hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps more, since 2001. 419,000 people were subjected to Schedule 7 stops between 2009 and 2019. An analysis published by Cambridge University in 2014 concluded that 88% of those stopped and interrogated without any suspicion of a crime were Muslim. The government has refused to release data as to how many were stopped between 2001 and 2009. Community centers were raided, protesters were arrested and prosecuted, funds were seized, families were terrorized, intimidated, and broken apart. This is the heavy-handed state infrastructure that is now being visited on the rest of us, including climate activists, along with those who post on social media in support of Palestine, condemn the apartheid and genocide of the Israeli state, or even oppose NATO. The Five Eyes intelligence services are building, as Craig Murray points out, Venn diagrams to connect all who oppose Zionism, neoliberalism, militarism, press censorship, corporate rule, and the devastation of the fossil fuel industry. And it will only get worse. University administrators in the U.S. spent the summer working in tandem with security consultants, many with ties to Israel, to determine the best ways to stifle protests this fall. They have imposed near universal bans on encampments, temporary structures, amplified sound, chalking, freestanding signs, flyering, outdoor displays, and event tables. A whisper of dissent in or out of the classroom will see protesting students and faculty expelled or arrested. There was a decade of popular uprisings from 2010 until the global pandemic in 2020. These uprisings shook the foundations of the global order. They denounced corporate domination, austerity cuts, the failure to address the climate crisis, and demanded economic justice and civil rights. There were nationwide protests in the United States centered around the 59-day Obama encampment. Occupy encampments, which were destroyed by Obama. There were popular eruptions in Greece, Spain, Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Turkey, Brazil, Ukraine, Hong Kong, Chile, and during South Korea's candlelight revolution. Discredited politicians were driven from office in Greece, Spain, Ukraine, South Korea, Egypt, Chile, and Tunisia. Reform, or at least the promise of it, dominated public discourse. It seemed to herald a new era. Then the backlash. The aspirations of the popular movements were crushed. State control and state inequality, rather than being curtailed, expanded. There was no significant change. In most cases, things got worse. The far right emerged triumphant. What happened? How did a decade of mass protests that seemed to herald democratic openness, an end to state repression, a weakening of the domination of global corporations and financial institutions, and an era of freedom sputter to ignominious failure? What went wrong? How did the hated bankers and politicians maintain or regain control? As Vincent Bevins points out in his book, If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution, the techno-optimists who preached that new digital media was a revolutionary and democratizing force did not foresee that authoritarian governments, corporations, and internal security services could harness these digital platforms and turn them into engines of wholesale surveillance, censorship, and vehicles for propaganda and disinformation. The social media platforms that made popular protests possible were turned against us. Many mass movements, because they failed to implement hierarchical, disciplined, and coherent organizational structures, were unable to defend themselves. In the few cases when organized movements achieved power, as in Greece and Honduras, the international financiers and corporations conspired to ruthlessly wrest power back. In most cases, the ruling class swiftly filled the power vacuums created by these protests. They offered new brands to repackage the old system. This is the reason the 2008 Obama campaign was named Advertising Age's Marketer of the Year. It won the vote of hundreds of marketers, agency heads, and marketing services vendors gathered at the Association of National Advertisers annual conference. It beat out runners-up, Apple and Zappos. The professionals knew Barack Obama was a marketer's dream, and they have reprised the same con with Kamala Harris. Too often, the protests resembled flash mobs, with people pouring into public spaces and creating a media spectacle rather than engaging in a sustained, organized, and prolonged disruption of power. Guy Debord captures the futility of these spectacles in his book, Society of the Spectacle, noting that the age of the spectacle means those entranced by its images are molded to its laws. Anarchists and anti-fascists, such as those in the Black Bloc, often smashed windows, threw rocks at police, and overturned or burned cars. Random acts of violence, looting, and vandalism were justified in the jargon of the movement as components of feral or spontaneous insurrection. This riot porn delighted the media, many of those who engaged in it, and not coincidentally the police, which used it to justify further repression and demonize the protest movement. An absence of political theory led activists to use popular culture, such as the film V for Vendetta, as reference points. The far more effective and crippling tools of grassroots educational campaigns, strikes, and boycotts were ignored or sidelined, perhaps because they are much harder and much less glamorous. But as Karl Marx understood, those who cannot represent themselves will be represented. Only highly organized movements that are structured around representation will save us. We thought representation was elitism, but actually it is the essence of democracy, Hossam Bhagat, the Egyptian investigative journalist and human rights campaigner, tells Bevin in the book. And all revolutionary movements need to be embedded in labor. Otherwise, any power vacuum that opens up will be filled by the corporate elites, who, of course, are very well organized. The problem was that the institutions and structures of control during the decade protests remained intact. They may, as in Egypt, have turned on the figureheads of the old regime, but they also worked to undermine popular movements and populist leaders. They sabotaged efforts to wrest power from global corporations and oligarchs. They prevented or removed populists from office. The vicious campaign waged against Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters when he headed the Labour Party during the 2017 and 2019 UK general elections, for example, was orchestrated by members within his own party, corporations, Zionists, the conservative opposition, celebrity commentators, a mainstream press that amplified the smears and character assassination, members of the British military, and the nation's security services. Disciplined political organizations are not in and of themselves sufficient, as Greece's left-wing Syriza party proved. If the leadership of an anti-establishment party is not willing to break free from the existing power structures, they will be co-opted or crushed when their demands are rejected by the reigning centers of power. Syriza eventually became an appendage of the international banking system. The Iranian-American sociologist Asif Bayat, who lived through both the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the 2011 uprising in Egypt, distinguishes between subjective and objective conditions for the Arab Spring uprisings that erupted in 2010. The protesters may have opposed neoliberal policies, but they also were shaped, he argues, by neoliberal subjectivity. The Arab revolutions lacked the kind of radicalism in political and economic outlook that marked most other 20th century revolutions. Bayat writes in his book, Revolution Without Revolutionaries, Making Sense of the Arab Spring. Unlike the revolutions of the 1970s that espoused a powerful socialist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and social justice impulse, Arab revolutionaries were preoccupied more with the broad issues of human rights, political accountability, and legal reform. The prevailing voices, secular and Islamist alike, took free market, property relations, and neoliberal rationality for granted, an uncritical worldview that would pay only lip service to the genuine concerns of the masses for social justice and distribution. As Bevan notes, a generation of individuals raised to view everything as if it were a business enterprise was de-radicalized, came to view this global order as natural, and became unable to imagine what it takes to carry out a true revolution. The popular uprisings, as Bevan notes, did a very good job of blowing holes in social structures and creating political vacuums. But the power vacuums were swiftly filled in Egypt by the military, in Bahrain by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council, in Kyiv by a different set of oligarchs and well-organized militant nationalists. In Turkey, it was eventually filled by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and in Hong Kong, it was Beijing. The horizontally structured, digitally coordinated, leaderless mass protest is fundamentally illegible, Bevans writes. You cannot gaze upon it or ask it questions and come up with a coherent interpretation based on evidence. You can assemble facts, absolutely, millions of them. You are just not going to be able to use them to construct an authoritative reading. This means that the significance of these events will be imposed upon them from the outside. In order to understand what might happen after any given protest explosion, you must not only pay attention to who is waiting in the wings to fill a power vacuum, you have to pay attention to who has the power to define the uprising itself. The lack of hierarchical structures in recent mass movements, done to prevent a leadership cult and make sure all voices are heard while noble in its aspirations, make movements easy prey. By the time Zuccotti Park, where I spent a lot of time, had hundreds of people attending general assemblies, for example, the diffusion of voices and opinions meant paralysis, especially once the movement was heavily infiltrated by police, the FBI, and Homeland Security. Peter Kropotkin makes this point, writing that consensus works in small groups, He caps the number at 150, but cripples large organizations. Revolutions require skilled organizers, self-discipline, an alternative ideological vision, revolutionary art, and education. They require sustained disruptions of power, and most importantly, leaders who represent the movement. Revolutions are long, difficult projects that take years to make, slowly and often imperceptibly eating away at the foundations of power. The successful revolutions of the past, along with their theorists, should be our guide, not the ephemeral images that entrance us on mass media. Revolution is not ultimately, as Roger said, a political calculation. It is a moral one. It is grounded in a vision of another world, another way of being. It is driven in the end by a moral imperative, especially since many of those who begin a revolution do not survive to see its fulfillment. Revolutionaries know that, as Immanuel Kant wrote, if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And this means that, like Socrates, we must come to a place where it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. We must at once see and act. And given what it means to see, this will require the surmounting of despair, not by reason, but by faith. I saw in the conflicts I covered the power of this faith, which lies outside any religious or philosophical creed. This faith is what Havel calls in his essay, the power of the powerless, living in truth. Living in truth exposes the corruption, lies, and deceit of the state. It is a refusal to be part of the charade. You do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career, Havel writes. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He or she is not seeking power. He or she has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He or she does not attempt to charm the public. He or she offers nothing and promises nothing. He or she can offer, if anything, only their own skin, and they offer it solely because they have no other way of affirming the truth they stand for. Their actions simply articulate their dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost. The long, long road of sacrifice and suffering that led to the collapse of the communist regimes stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet these dissidents, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, and writers finally triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken the masses around them appeared, their message of defiance did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion constantly exposed the dead hand of authority and rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of rebellious Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslas Square as the singer Marta Kubashova approached the balcony of the Metternich building. Kuibyshova had been banished from the airwaves in 1968 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, A Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed by the state. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, many of whom had not been born when she was disappeared. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of rebellion. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. It was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The people will once again decide their own fate, the crowd sang in unison with Kuibyshova. The walls of Prague were covered that chilly winter with posters depicting Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Wenceslas Square on January 16, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democratic movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by police. Palach's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother, with the provision that his ashes could not be placed in the cemetery. But it did not work. His defiance remained a rallying cry. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act. Prague's Red Army Square, shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Palach Square. 10,000 people went to the dedication. We, like those who oppose the long night of communism, no longer have any mechanisms within the formal structures of power that will protect or advance our rights. We too have undergone a corporate coup d'etat, carried out not by the stone-faced leaders of a monolithic communist party, but the corporate state. We may feel, in the face of the ruthless corporate destruction of our nation, our culture, and our ecosystem, powerless and weak, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements that follow. It sustains another narrative. It will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we will keep this possibility alive. If we do not, it will die. Reinhold Niebuhr labeled this capacity to defy the forces of repression a sublime madness in the soul. Niebuhr wrote that nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. This sublime madness, as Niebuhr understood, is dangerous, but it is vital. Without it, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also knew that traditional liberalism was a useless force in moments of extremity. Liberalism, Niebuhr wrote, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. The prophets in the Hebrew Bible had this sublime madness. The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night. While the world is at ease and asleep, the prophet feels the blast from heaven. The prophet, because he or she saw and faced an unpleasant reality, was, as Heschel wrote, compelled to proclaim the very opposite of what his or her heart expected. This sublime madness is essential. It is the acceptance that when you stand with the oppressed, you will be treated like the oppressed. It is the acceptance that although empirically all that we have struggled to achieve during our lifetime may be worse, our struggle validates itself. As Hannah Arendt writes in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say, I can't. Karl Popper in The Open Society and Its Enemies writes that the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Popper says this is the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, he writes, have rarely been above average, either morally or intellectually, and often been below it. The question is how do we build forces to restrict the despotism of the powerful? There is a moment in Henry Kissinger's memoirs, do not buy the book, when Nixon and Kissinger are looking out at tens of thousands of anti-war protesters who have surrounded the White House. The Nixon administration had placed empty city buses in a ring around the White House to keep the protesters back. Nixon looked out the window and said to Kissinger, Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us. And that is exactly where we want people in power to be. And this is why, although he was not a liberal, Nixon was our last liberal president. He was scared of movements. And if we cannot make the elite scared of us, we will fail. We must build organized structures of open defiance. It may take years. But without a potent counterweight, without an alternative vision, and alternative structures of self-rule, we will be steadily disempowered. Every action we take, every word we utter, must make it clear that we refuse to participate in our own enslavement and our own destruction. And courage is contagious. Revolutions begin, as I saw in East Germany, with a few Lutheran clergy holding candles as they marched through the streets of Leipzig. It ends with 500,000 people protesting in East Berlin, the defection of the police and the army to the side of the protesters, and the collapse of the Stasi state. But revolutions only happen when a few dissidents decide they will no longer cooperate. We may not succeed, so be it. At least those who come after us, and I speak as a father, will say we tried. The corporate forces that have us in their death grip will destroy our lives. They will destroy the lives of my children. They will destroy the lives of your children. They will destroy the ecosystem that makes life possible. We owe it to those who come after us not to be complicit in this evil. We owe it to them to refuse to be good Germans. And in the end, I do not fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.